Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Detroit, Michigan, became a lawyer, and in 1955, he ran unsuccessfully against John Dingell Jr. to fill the congressional seat held by the late John Dingell Sr. In 1969, at age 39, he became the youngest Michigan Supreme Court Chief Justice in our state's history. In 1972, he founded the Thomas M. Cooley Law School, which today is America's largest accredited law school. His name, the Honorable Judge Thomas E. Brennan. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're with Judge Thomas E. Brennan, who was Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court in 69 and 70. Judge, welcome. A real honor to have you.
It's a delight to be here, Jack.
You are a member of the greatest generation. Fabulous generation you people sacrificed, and you had great parents. What's the best thing about your mom, and what's the best thing about your dad?
Well, my mom was had been a secretary for an executive at Ford Motor Company before she was married. And in those days, a married woman couldn't work in the most companies. If you got married, you had to leave. And so she and my dad were engaged for a long time, I guess until they could accumulate enough money to buy a house. But she was a very bright lady, and she was she liked to write. She wrote a lot of poetry. And I think she inspired me to letters, to think about words, to think about writing. She typed up my papers when I was in grade school, and so she was a great inspiration from that standpoint. My dad was a rock. He was a rock of integrity. He was Joel Brennan in the neighborhood. He was Mr. Brennan, and he was just a pillar of the church, a pillar of the community. The local Republican precinct delegate, air warden during the Second World War. He was a rock, and he was, for me, a rock. He was a man who gave me some great advice. One of the best things he ever told me was, Tom, you know what's right and you know what's wrong. Do what's right. Now, that was a Joe Brennan speech. That was a long speech for him.
Why did you decide to become a lawyer?
When I was at the Epiphany Grade School on the west side of Detroit as a youngster, we had a wonderful nun, Sister Stephanie Mueller, who I believe is still living at about the age of 92 or 93, but who told me when I was in the sixth grade or so, Brennan, you love to argue. You should be a lawyer. And so that sort of stuck in my head. You know, I like to argue with people. I argued with her all the time.
You were one of five kids growing up on the west side of Detroit.
Yeah.
At age 22, you ran for the state legislature. You lost.
That's right.
1955, John Dingell Jr. beats you for his late dad's seat. 57, you run for judge, you lose. 59, you run for judge again, you lose. The newspapers were calling you a perennial loser.
Yes.
What did all those losses teach you?
That it was much better to win. than to lose. But they taught me a lot. They taught me that losing is not the end of the world. If you can't handle defeat, if you can't handle failure, you're probably never going to have any success. And you have to be willing to fail, and not happy about it, but willing to fail. If you're going to try, the failure is always a possibility. If you're going to play in the game, one team wins and one loses. So there's a lot of loss, there's a lot of failure in life, but I learned that you can overcome it.
How did your 9 years, Judge, of practicing law prepare you for being a judge?
Well, practicing law in Detroit back in those days, and we were, as young lawyers, spent a lot of our time in the Common Pleas Court of Detroit, which was the lower county court, like the district court is now. And you learn the idiosyncrasies of the judges. And I could go on and on about the goofy things they did and the offensive thing. We had a judge by the name of Ralph Liddy. And one of the things the judges did in those days, the common pleas judges, was they married people on Saturdays. One of the judges would have to do the weddings on a given Saturday. And they were typically given, $10 or something by the people who they married. And Ralph Liddy would wash the $10 bills in the sink with soap and water before he would put them in his pocket. I mean, come on. It was an idiosyncratic sort of thing. There were all of them. Old Tom Kenny was a fellow who had been the governor, Harry Kelly's legal advisor. And Tom was a pretty good drinker. And one day, Harry Kelly called him into his office. He said, "Tom, I'd like to appoint you as a judge down in Detroit, but you got to promise me you'll never touch another drop to drink." Tom says, "You got it, Governor." And he never did. So that...
In 1961, you were first elected to the Detroit Common Pleas Court.
Yeah.
So you went from being on this side of the desk to now this side of the desk. Yeah. What was the biggest change?
I always thought these black-robed minions of truth and virtue were great people, and they were wise careful in their judgments and so forth. And I learned quickly that they were very, very much like ordinary people. And when we had, I remember one of the early judges' meetings was summarily called by, I think, Judge Connolly was the presider at the time. And we all rushed down the back halls with our robes to go to his office and go together. And the big issue of the day was Harry Dingham and complaining about the fact that the municipal judges out in the suburbs and who were part-time judges and who practiced law and appeared before us in Detroit had been given robes and had a robing ceremony by the circuit court judges. And I remember Harry saying, "Well, look," and it was a big story in the Free Press, in the back of the Free Press, all these guys lined up getting their robes and somebody making a speech. And Harry Dingham pulled the paper out. Look at what they're doing to these guys, these part-time judges. And so forth. What do they do for us? I'll tell you what they do. Every time they turn your back, they cut your balls off. So I thought, boy, that's a classy thing. These guys. That's the way these guys talk when they're in the room, you know. So anyway, it was a great experience. And of course, as I went up into the circuit court and ultimately the Supreme Court, I found at every level that. They're just human beings.
We're talking to Judge Thomas Brennan, who's also a country western songwriter. So here's a piece of his famous song, Perseverance.
Perseverance, perseverance, perseverance is my name. When the rest have given up, I'll still be in the game. Well, I'm the tortoise, not the hare. When it's over, I'll be there. I keep going rain or shine till I cross that finish line. Perseverance, perseverance, perseverance is my name. When the rest have given up, I'll be in the Hall of Fame.
Perseverance, what a great message. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and with Judge Thomas E. Brennan, who in 1969, at the age of 39, you become the youngest Michigan Supreme Court Chief Justice in our state's history. 39 years old. How'd you ever do that?
Well, my predecessor was John Deathmers, a wonderful, kindly gentleman from the western part of the state, from Zeeland or thereabouts. And he was Chief Justice, and about that time, the Michigan State Officers Compensation Commission had been formed, and they set the salaries for the governor, the justices of the court, and the legislature, and they met every 2 years. So John Deathmers went down on behalf of the Supreme Court to see if he could get a raise. We were making $35,000 a year at the time, and his speech went something like this: "Well, gentlemen, Mrs. Deathmers and I get along nicely on what we're making, but the other boys would like a raise." Now, that was the extent of his pitch. And you can imagine the Compensation Commission felt about that. Oh, my gosh, you know. So I think some of the other justices said, we've got to get this aggressive young fellow Brennan as our Chief Justice and see what he can do on our behalf. And so I employed an expert, an economist, from Michigan State University, who prepared a great big dossier with all the information about what lawyers were making elsewhere and other judges were making, and got the court a 20% raise to 42,000, which in those days sounded pretty good. Although you have to remember, in those days, we were making 42,000. The outfielder for the Detroit Tigers was the first one to make 100,000, Al Kaline, which was twice, more than twice, what a justice of the Supreme Court was making. And now the court makes about 170,000, and the ball player makes 20 million. So you can see what's happened in the meantime.
Judge Brennan, what message would you give to a judge today?
Keep your nose clean, say your prayers, and do your job. I think it's a job that requires constant reaffirmation of why you're there, why you're on the bench, why the people of the state have given you the responsibility to make judgment of your fellow man. And if you're aware of that every day as you take the bench, you do all right. And you treat people with courtesy and kindness and understanding that, half of them are going to lose and half of them are going to win. None of them are wrong to be before you. They're all just doing what people do, and your job is to follow the law.
You served on the Michigan Supreme Court for 7 years.
Yes, I did.
What goes on in the conference rooms behind closed doors?
Well, I told you what happens in the Common Pleas Court, and the Circuit Court was much like that as well. It was not quite so vociferous, and there were some very interesting intellectual discussions in the conference rooms. There was a lot of give and take and a lot of pull of political and philosophical differences that the justices had, but typically it was always good fellowship. I remember Soapy Williams was on the court. I was on the court with Soapy and with John Swainson, Harry Kelly, three former governors who were colleagues of mine at one time or another. And when I came on the court, after I had been Chief Justice, Williams and Swainson were elected, and then you had a solid Democratic majority on the court, and they put Tom Kavanaugh back in as the Chief Justice. But I remember going out to lunch with the justices one time, and they all I drove to the restaurant and dropped them all off. They got in, and I parked the car and came and walked back to the door of the restaurant. Who was waiting for me? G. Menon Williams, who was a gentleman, and opened the door and let me in. But so they were, and despite the fact that I was on opposite sides of a lot of things with Tom Kavanaugh. I was instrumental in dumping him as Chief Justice when I first came on the court. When I left the court, Tom threw a wonderful dinner party for me and my wife and all the wives and the members of the court. It was a very gracious, cordial thing.
We're talking to Judge Thomas Brennan, who in 1976 ran unsuccessfully, but ran for U.S. Senator from Michigan. After 7 years serving Michigan Supreme Court, you stepped down. You're 46 years old at the time. Were you crazy? I mean, were you going through a midlife crisis? When you went home to Polly that night and said, honey, I quit my job, why did you step down?
Well, I had started the law school, it was a storefront operation. It was on a wing and a prayer. I think it's my total capitalization was a $15,000 letter of credit from Michigan National Bank, and I was opposed by the establishment. I was opposed by the other law schools. The Detroit Free Press went after me tooth and nail, writing all kinds of vitriolic articles about me and so forth. And I was concerned that the law school was going to fail, and that we had students there who had paid money for their tuition, who had dreams of becoming lawyers. And we're taking my son down to school in Ohio. He was in a seminary school. And we stopped, Polly and I and John were driving. We stopped at a little restaurant, Dutch pantry, what restaurant and so forth. And we went in, and it was kind of dirty, and so the service was slow, and the silverware was looked like it hadn't been washed. And we got back in the car, and I said to Polly, I said, you know, it's too bad. Somebody had a great idea for a chain of restaurants, and this isn't happening because he hasn't got anybody running it properly. We drove in silence for a while, and I finally turned to her. I said, I think I'm going to quit the court. I think I have to run that law school myself. And so we went down, dropped John off at the school. We went to the Holiday Inn. We sat up all night on the floor at the Holiday Inn talking about what I was going to do. I mean, we had kids, we had obligations and so forth. Could I leave the court, and could we make a living good with this little storefront law school? But she's always been with me, and so she was with me on that.
You didn't name it the Thomas E. Brennan Law School. You named it the Thomas M. Cooley Law School.
Sure.
Who was Thomas M. Cooley?
Well, Thomas M. Cooley was a very famous justice of the Michigan Supreme Court right after the Civil War. Was on the court for maybe 20 years during that period of time. He was one of the first faculty members at the University of Michigan Law School. He wrote all kinds of books, Cooley on constitutional limitations, Cooley on torts. He was a very, very scholarly man who was and remains an icon in legal education and in the law in the United States of America, so much so that Ronald Reagan, when he was president, speaking to the American Bar Association, quoted Judge Cooley. And here, the other great thing about it was that he was dead, because you don't name anything after somebody still living. And his legacy was established, and he was a beloved and an honored member of the court.
We're talking to Judge Thomas E. Brennan, and a few traits that define our guest would be leadership, character, enthusiasm, humility, courage, humor, and warmth. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Judge Thomas E. Brennan, who in 1972 founded the Thomas M. Cooley Law School, which is now the largest accredited law school in America. Judge, what message would you give to a listener tonight who's thinking about becoming a lawyer?
Well, I think, first of all, the law is a learned profession. And it's not just a mechanical thing. You have to have a base of knowledge, history, philosophy, and certainly the English language. You have to be articulate in the English language. I think one of the things that we discover these days is that people are getting through college, undergraduate college, and they can hardly write a sensible letter to apply for a job. And spell everything correctly and have all the punctuation proper. So part of it is just a basic education is absolutely necessary if you're thinking of becoming a lawyer.
I've heard it said that the profession of law is a calling, a vocation. Why?
Well, as a profession, I think it is so, because the practicing attorneys are officers of the court. They are part of the system of justice in our society. But Jack, the word lawyer is a broad word. It means a person learned in the law. It means a person who knows and studies the law. So you can be a lawyer and not be an attorney at law who is licensed to practice. And it's an unfortunate thing because people say, oh, you got to start a law school. Well, we already got too many lawyers. You know, that's the sort of reaction. Oh, you got too many lawyers. Well, the bar examination determines how many lawyers are going to be in that sense, how many attorneys, people are licensed to practice law and charge money for it. That's one thing. That's the bar, admission to the bar. But learning the law, learning contracts and torts and corporations and constitutional, oh, my Lord, the ignorance about the Constitution of the United States of America in this country is appalling. And so legal studies and the study of the law is something that is a lot broader than just educating people to be practicing attorneys.
You were the president of the law school from 79 to 2002.
Yeah.
Cooley Law School has graduated over 11,000 students. Today, 42 years after you formed it, when you walk through its doors, what do you say to God?
Thank God I'm out of here. I've enjoyed my retirement, and I've been busy writing a book, which will be published shortly. So it's been a great blessing to have had a successful career that I was able to lay aside and go on with the twilight years. And I'm comfortable about that. When I go to Cooley Law School, I go anywhere near the law school, whether it's one of the branch campuses or the main campus, they treat me like a rock star. I mean, everybody thinks, oh, Judge Benninger, hi, Judge, how are you, and so forth. And some of the folks that were still there, that were there when I was there, are very gracious and greeting me and so forth. All the girls want to give me a kiss, and it's nice to be loved. I don't say that I deserve any of that. All I know is that they treat me very nicely.
Speaking of writing the book is the Article 5 Amendatory Constitutional Convention.
Yes.
And Benjamin Franklin once told a lady, we're giving you a republic if you can keep it. Tell us about the book, the Article 5 Amendatory Constitutional Convention.
Well, Article 5 of the United States Constitution spells out how the Constitution can be amended. And it says that the Constitution can be amended basically in two ways. I should say two by two. There are two ways to propose amendments, and there are two ways to ratify amendments. The amendments can be proposed by the Congress. All they need is two-thirds vote in both houses of the Congress, and they can propose an amendment. Or amendments can be proposed by a convention called by the Congress at the request of two-thirds of the states. Then once an amendment has been proposed in one of these two ways, it goes out to be ratified by the states, and the Congress determines whether it's to be ratified by the state legislatures or by conventions in each of the states. Now, only one of the 27 amendments to our federal Constitution was ratified by conventions, and that was the repeal of prohibition. But all the others were ratified by the legislatures of the states, and that was a decision that the Congress made. So not many people know anything about how the Constitution is amended. And
your latest venture is to try and organize a national constitutional convention.
Right.
Why and how?
Well, that's interesting because there's a lot of dispute about how the convention would be organized. If Article 5 is used and the states ask for a convention and the Congress calls it, you have to remember that the convention that met in Philadelphia and wrote the Constitution, they provided for these two ways to propose amendments for a very good reason. Because any amendment that the Congress thought was a good idea, the Congress could propose. So the only thing you need a convention for is to propose amendments that the Congress doesn't want. For example, term limits for congressmen. And my friend John Dingell has turned out to be the longest-serving congressman in the history of the country. Elected first in 1955, he's still there. God bless him. But the point is that the founders of our nation thought that there would be some time when amendments were needed that the Congress would not propose. And therefore, there had to be a convention to propose amendments.
Judge Thomas Brennan, what would George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison say to us today?
Well, they certainly would say that we never decided, we never proposed a constitution or formed a country where we were going to have a king. We never proposed a country where we would have a monarch or a person in the White House as a president who had the power to order people killed for political reasons or for any reason. I think the president would, when the New York Times comes out and says the president has a kill list, which is determined based on somebody saying that these people are dangerous and they're going to mean us harm and they need to be eliminated, I think that George Washington would be shocked. I mean, that was, kings used to do that years and years ago. Behead him, you know, he's an enemy of the king. But that was never the way our country was supposed to be run. That's only one small thing. Not small, but one thing. I think they would be shocked to discover at this point in time that the House of Representatives in Washington has been frozen at 435 people for 100 years. They said in the Constitution that the House of Representatives was to be proportional to the population. It was proportional up until about 1910, and then they froze it at 435. So that every 10 years, we have more and more people. The census says we have more and more people. They're still represented by the same number of representatives in Congress. That means that their constituency keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So with a big constituency, what do? You go to get reelected. You go on television. You spend a lot of money. So if you represent a million people, you've got to raise a lot of money and spend a lot of money to get reelected. And that's what they do. So if you had smaller districts, which is our forefathers intended, a fella could go out and knock on doors and ask his neighbors to vote for him. Didn't do that anymore. We're all big business, and now politics is now big business. But it's because we didn't do what our founders intended us to do.
We're talking to Judge Thomas E. Brennan, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Judge Thomas E. Brennan, who was, at 39, named the youngest Michigan Supreme Court Chief Justice, 1969-1970. Judge, a lot of people are concerned about the attack on religious freedom in America today. What are your thoughts?
Well, certainly the provisions of our Constitution protecting our religious freedom are fundamental to our happiness as a people, to our success as a nation, and to the continuance of the nation. We see some, history records all kinds of religious wars, Christians against Muslims and Protestants against Catholics, and in Ireland they called it the Troubles, and the Troubles went on for 700 years. Probably one of the principal reasons for war almost has been this dispute between religious views. And yet religion is so much the foundation of organized society. People who believe in common what they are, what kind of a creature a human being is, what a human being's destiny is, what are we doing on this planet. Those are fundamental questions that, when people agree on them, become the basis for their civil governance, for their that's the way they want to act as a community, because they have a common idea of what it is they are as human beings. So it makes sense that that religion is important in society, and it's important that we all have the freedom to believe as we wish and to worship as we wish.
You have a mantra, a philosophy of life. Would you please share it with us?
Well, as you brought out, I've had a lot of failure in my life, and I've generally failed two or three times before I had my coffee in the morning. But I always say, and I told my kids this, and I've told my students at the law school and elsewhere, if you drop it, pick it up. If you spill it, wipe it up. If you forget it, go back and get it. If you break it, fix it. If you destroy it, replace it. And if you start it, finish it. If you do it wrong, do it over and do it right. If you owe it, pay it. If you did it, admit it. And always remember that most of the forward progress we make in the game of life is getting back to the line of scrimmage.
Tom Brennan, you know, if Hollywood had met you before they met Judge Judy, you'd be rich, and there would be no Judge Judy. You're 85 years young. You have a fantastic zest for life. How do I get that?
Eat your vegetables. That's what my wife says. Eat your vegetables. And I try. I'm encased in the love of a good woman. And when your wife loves you enough to tell you to you know, blouse your sweater and and comb your hair, you're talking about the great blessing of life. And so it troubles me to see in our society that traditional marriage is kind of being put on the back burner, and young people are going forward to this new lifestyle of one kind or another, get a job and work until you're 30 or 5 or 4 years of old before you even think about getting married. And then it's not to have children, it's just to have company. And I think that the family is the basic unit of society, but it's also the basic tent under which we live in our lives. And so the relationship of a man and a woman, and the two of them to their children, is what makes life long and happy.
One of your books, where you talk about how to build a law school, one chapter is entitled "The Wind Beneath My Wings."
Ah, yes.
And you talk about your 64-year love story with Pauline Mary Weinberger Brennan.
Yes.
And I quote, "is a very special human being. I'm fond of telling her that she is the best person in the whole world. She demurs appropriately. I don't think she has any notion of how important she has been in everything I have tried to do over the last half century." Tom Brennan, what's the best thing about Polly?
Oh, the best thing about... Oh, that's impossible. That's a terrible question. But the best thing about her, her meatloaf. I'm telling you, her meatloaf you could die for. Listen, you could die for the meatloaf. And it is wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
After 64 years, it don't get no better than that. One of the many crises we have in America is the crisis of men and being a great man. You talk about your dad, Joe Brennan, just a great man. You're a great man. How do our men today become great men?
I think there's been a diminution of sexual identity in this country, and it's unhappy. I attended an all boys Catholic high school, and the song that we sang was to the Blessed Mother, and it was about Mary Alma Mater. She was the mother of our school, and I forget the exact words in the song, but that every day in every way we would try to prove that we are men, And the word men in that sense, or man, it means manliness. It means not masculine muscles necessarily, or violence or anything of that kind, but courage, steadiness, integrity, those kinds of manly attributes and virtues that the priests taught us at Catholic Central. Teach us goodness, discipline, and knowledge. Goodness, discipline, and knowledge. Three things that go together to make a man, in my opinion.
You end your book about building a law school by saying, to be loved is an inestimable gift, which is only enjoyed when it is returned. And so it is.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the best you can do, isn't it? It's to return the love that's given to you. And I've been given a lot in my life, and I try to give it back as best I can.
As our time winds down together, Judge, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
Oh, my. eat your vegetables, hey? I don't know. Every person has a different role to play in our society, and they each have to kind of find their own way, their own job that is intended for them. But I think they should have inquisitiveness, learning. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is, people worry about getting a job. You know, I want to get a degree so I can get a job. It's not the degree that gets the job, it's the knowledge. And there's a person that I write about in my book that I think is ought to be one of the great heroes of our nation, Jimmy Wales. He was educated, homeschooled by his grandmother down in Alabama, and ultimately grew up to be the man who started Wikipedia. Wikipedia on the internet, the ultimate universal dictionary that everybody can contribute to, that his goal was to put all human knowledge on the internet. And he's done a grand job of it. But knowledge is the power, not the credential, not the certificate, not the diploma. It's what you know that counts.
Judge Tom Brennan, you talk about a shining example of the greatest generation. You epitomize that. Thanks for all you've done. You're a living treasure.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be with you, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoke.
Believe in yourself.